Hello, I'm Kim Fraser. This is number 0360, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0360. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Chris Epting, who is the co-author of Making Waves. He wrote the book with famed Olympic gold medal swimmer Shirley Babashoff. How they met was an interesting coincidence.
My mom always talked about her mail carrier, Shirley. And one day she says, Shirley's son has one of your books and wanted to know if you would sign it to him. And I said, sure. So she connects me with Shirley via email. And Shirley says at the end of our conversation, hey, maybe you want to write a story about me one day. And I said, well, sure. Who are you? And she goes, my name is Shirley Babashoff. You know, once I picked myself up off the floor, I mean, I remembered I was at the Olympics in Montreal in 1976 with my family on vacation. We saw her swim. And I was also very familiar with the fact that she had been the one to call out the East Germans for doping and really paid a price for it. The world was not yet ready to hear those sorts of accusations.
Sword swallower Dan Meyer is back on again to talk about his return to the television show America's Got Talent.
They called me out of the blue on a Monday afternoon and said, hey, would you like to be back on America's Got Talent? I said, sure, when? 2017? What, Miami, Orlando? They said, no, tomorrow, Hollywood. I'm like, what? And we made things happen very quickly. I flew in late the next day and got in about 2 in the morning, and we filmed all day that day, and they had me come on about midnight that night. And what you see on tape was after about 2 days of travel with about 3 hours of sleep and no food. But it was so much fun, and it went over way better than I could have ever hoped for or imagined.
And Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter looks at the life and career of the cute Beatle himself, or Sir Paul, or Maka, Paul McCartney, in Paul McCartney the Life. So get your 1964 Hofner bass guitar ready. Showtime is coming up shortly on the Stuff File program.
Plus, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0360 was Kim Fraser, the marketing VP at the Montreal Children's Hospital Foundation. You can go to their website and see their link, and you'll find the link on the website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which you just heard Kim mention, and you'll find that link to the Montreal Children's Hospital Foundation. And thank you very much, Kim, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? To what lengths would you go to smuggle yourself into a country? Would you go as far as this guy did? A nearly 6-foot-tall man was caught on a surveillance camera emerging from a suitcase at a train station in Switzerland. Video shot by a Swiss border guard shows the man's hand sticking out from the suitcase before officers arrive to fully unzip the bag. The man was from Eritrea and had packed himself into the suitcase to cross the border from Italy into Switzerland. The man, who was about one of 3,400 migrants attempting to enter Switzerland's Ticino region, was ultimately sent back to Italy after being discovered inside the suitcase by border guards. Okay, this shows you just how spoiled we are here in the Western world. You know, here's a guy who's willing to travel stuffed inside a suitcase. And as I mentioned, he's 6 foot tall. Meanwhile, most of us gripe about cramped seating on planes and trains. It's all about perspective, people. All about perspective. Well, an English woman who became famous, more or less, for making an entire dress out of 3,000 Skittles has just figured out how to roll that fame into something much more disgusting. 28-year-old Sarah Louise Bryan has just finished a skirt and bra outfit made entirely of human hair. Not her own, which would be gross enough. No, she had to go to social media to ask people to donate their hair. Why? because the hair she wanted to use was pubic hair. And thanks to the completely shameless nature of the internet, she got more than enough to finish her project. Sarah said she received thousands of responses. Wearing gloves for protection, Sarah was forced to wear a face and eye mask after she started gagging while working on the dress. But the mother of two has no plans to slow down her creations and wants to go on and design even more disgusting outfits. "I love creating wearable art from things no one else would think of. I pride myself in being the first in the world to create something so unique." You can find pictures of her wearing the dress online if you feel like you can stomach it, because it will test your gag reflexes. You know, I don't know what's more weird, her asking for people to send in their pubic hair or people who gleefully are willing to collect it and send it in. That's an interesting bunch of people, to say the least. Okay, an inmate who escaped from prison voluntarily surrendered himself to police after grabbing a few drinks at a bar. Logan County, Arkansas police said that 45-year-old Sean Higgum went to Mitch's Tavern in Paris before telling the owner that he wants to go back to jail. According to the police investigation, Higgum picked the lock of his cell and left the Logan County jail. The following week, he showed up at the bar dressed in his prison uniform, and he was covered with insect bites. He was also dirty and smelly. After drinking at the bar, Higgum told the owner that he escaped from prison and wanted to turn himself in. The bar owner immediately called the police, and Higgum was arrested. Higgum was in prison on an aggravated robbery charge. I guess he missed his cell service. Yeah. You know, what I want to know is why the bartender waited until the guy said he was an escaped convict to, you know, call the cops and turn him in. I mean, he was still wearing his prison uniform. It's not like it was Halloween or anything, you know? Anyway, that outfit should have been an immediate warning to maybe call the authorities. I'm just saying. Anyway, we have one more item before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it's the latest Airbnb offerings in Salinas, California. It's a gas station stayover. That's right. You can stay the night at a gasoline filling station and convenience store, and it's just $50 to fulfill any childhood dream of sleeping at a gas station, according to owner Peter Shen. Okay, let's stop right there. Who among ye has ever had the desire to spend a night sleeping at a gas station? I must have missed that part of my childhood. Anyway, while you can have all you can drink from the soda fountain and coffee and ice cream and, well, some running water, you have to bring your own air mattress since there are no beds. You're not allowed to check in until closing time, which is 10 p.m., and you must check out by opening time, which is 5 a.m. Rather than stay in a real nice, comfy, luxury place, this has a real nice experience, Shen says. They will lock you in for your own protection, and there's good lighting and surveillance cameras for your protection as well. What more can you ask for? Well, maybe an air mattress. After all, it is Airbnb. But I digress. Okay, so we checked deeper into the story, which first broke in late June. They had a couple of stayovers. However, the listing has since been removed from Airbnb's website. Now, it's unclear whether it violated an Airbnb policy or if the owner just got cold feet about hosting guests and giving them unfettered access to the Slurpee machine. In any case, your lifelong dreams of spending time overnight in a locked gas station have now just been dashed. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Chris Epting is back on the program with us. He's an author and photographer who has cranked out 25 history and travel books, including James Dean Died Here, Roadside Baseball, Led Zeppelin Crashed Here, and more. His latest is a collaboration with gold medal winning Olympic swimmer Shirley Babishoff. The book is called Making Waves, and Chris is on the line via Skype from California. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Ah, just tickety-boo. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
Well, it's always good to talk to you. We've done this now for so many years. It wouldn't be a book release without a conversation with you.
You have a wide variety of books out there, and there's shall we say something about the way you write that there's a commonality with them, yet they're all different.
Yeah, I think the to me the common thread is popular culture and history. You know, and a good story. I mean, like everybody who writes, I love a good story, and this is certainly that. And the way it came to me was so bizarre. My mom, a number of years ago, always talked about her mail carrier, Shirley, and my mom gets to know everybody in her world. And one day she says, you know, Shirley's son has one of your books and wanted to know if you would sign it to him. And I said, sure. So she connects me with Shirley via email. And Shirley says at the end of our conversation, hey, maybe you want to write a story about me one day. And I said, well, sure. Who are you? You know, you're always curious. And she goes, my name is Shirley Babishoff. And, you know, once I picked myself up off the floor, I mean, I remembered I was at the Olympics in Montreal in 1976 with my family on vacation. We saw her swim. And I was also very familiar with the fact that she had been the one to call out the East Germans for doping in 76 and really paid a price for it. The world was not yet ready to hear those sorts of accusations. And as it turned out, when the wall came down in 89, she was completely right. And I never knew what happened to her. Well, lo and behold, she's been a mail carrier in Huntington Beach, where I live, for 30 years and had never told her story. After the whole thing happened, she retired at age 19, just after the Olympics, and started a new life as a mail carrier. She was so fed up with having swam 20 miles a day, 7 days a week for 4 years in anticipation of the 76 games, then to get ripped off like she did. I mean, she came out of there with four silvers. The East Germans, of course, won the gold in every case. And the East Germans cheated every female swimmer that year. And she was so fed up and disgusted with the death threats and everything she received, she just bailed at age 19 and took up a new career. So it was, for me, this amazing kind of sports story never told that fell into my lap. We became friends, you know, built up some trust. And then in anticipation of the 40th anniversary this year and this being an Olympic year, we thought this would be a good time to release it. So it comes out right now.
Well, is it kind of kismet? I mean, it's the fact that you are writing this book and writing this book with her, she coming forward and telling you who she is. She had the opportunity, especially considering there has been doping stories in the news of recent over the last couple of years, she chose to come to you and tell her story. It's almost like fate.
It was totally fate. I mean, this one was so bizarre. And I mean, at the time we got to know each other, we became friends and we would hang out and she'd say, look, I'm not ready to tell my story yet, but when I am, maybe you and I could talk about it. For Shirley, trust was key. She felt like she had been raked over by so many journalists and writers that she really had no interest in just jumping back in. But the more we got to know each other, she said, you know what? I trust that you'll do an honest job with it. I feel a comfort level and a chemistry. And so I think if you want to do this, you would be the right person. And, you know, the fact that she was my mom's mail carrier is just, and that we saw her swim, you know, is just so crazy. When I let my mom know, my mom is a big sports fan, I said, do you know who Shirley is? Because she looks different now, of course, after 40 years. My mother couldn't believe it. I mean, that Shirley never mentioned it because she really doesn't. You got to draw it out of her. But as we sat down the last 2 years to work on this story, and it's been about that long, there are so many amazing twists and turns in this woman's life. And she's a great hero, I think. And what she did in Montreal, I mean, it culminates in the last race of the Olympics, the relay, where she and her three teammates, these four teenage girls, sat up all night. And they figured out a way to beat the East Germans, not with doping, obviously, but with ingenuity and timing and strategy. And they went out there the next day against all odds, and they did it. And in fact, a new documentary just came out called The Last Gold, all about Shirley and her win that year with her teammates in 76. So it's a great year for her. There's a lot going on, a lot of focus on that event and what it meant. And looking around us today with the steroids culture, it really was kind of ground zero of the modern steroids era.
A lot of people would be aware of who Shirley is and what she did in 1976 in the Olympics and probably watched it on television. What was the reaction she gave you when she realized that not only had you seen her swim, you saw her swim live?
we still laugh about it. I mean, our meeting, like you say, kismet, fate, all those words apply. The whole thing is so ridiculous that we just, at this point, nothing surprises us. She's become like a family member to my family. We absolutely adore her. She and I rode in a parade just yesterday here in Huntington Beach. I mean, really, we've had a great journey as friends. And that, to me, has been the most fun part about this, is doing something with a friend. I mean, I'm a, certain projects, you do them, and then everybody moves on. This one isn't like that. I'll know Shirley the rest of my life. And so I really took very special care in making sure the story was told properly with her. And the reaction so far has been amazing. I mean, Mark Spitz wrote a beautiful preface to the book, and Donna DeVerona wrote a piece, and John Neighbor. The swimming greats have all stepped up. I mean, I was at an event a few months ago, and Michael Phelps came over to me, and he said, "Hey, are you here with Shirley?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Would you please take a photo of us together?" I mean, the younger swimmers get it, too. They understand the trails that she blazed back in the 70s, and they completely admire her and love her. And so, again, for Shirley, I think it's a real coming out party. It's a chance for her to get back in touch with the swimming community and also to tell her story and come to grips with what happened to her. Because, look, had she come out of those games with 6 gold medals, her life would have been radically different. There would have been the Wheaties box, the endorsements, all of those things. And yet, for merely speaking out and saying, "Hey, everybody, world, take a look at these East German girls," for that, she just got vilified by everybody. Because, again, the world wasn't quite ready. We didn't know the word steroids in 1976. So nobody was really able to, you know, look, to me, it was a Pulitzer opportunity for some journalists. This is only 2 years after Watergate. It still kind of stuns me that nobody had the guts or gumption to jump on this and deal with it, but they didn't. And so it was all on Shirley to go in and face the press every day and just get hammered with questions about why she was such a poor sport. And, you know, like I said, everything happens for a reason, and at this point, the timing of the book, I think, is great. It's a chance for her to kind of finally address everything that was going on then. And I think people will learn a lot about the Olympics, about what society was like back then, and why it's important to not cheat. That's a big thing with Shirley, is now going out and speaking to youth groups about why it's so important to stay pure, you know, and do your best based on your ability, you know, and not messing with that at all chemically. It really matters to her. So she's got a lot of new platforms to talk from now.
Well, as you mentioned, she was a bit skittish and leery of the press as the way she was treated over the years when she first brought this story to attention. Now that this book is coming out, now that it's a 40th anniversary, and with assistance from you, do you find, pardon the pun, that she is finding it easier to dip her toe into the pool of journalism once again and press and dealing with?
No, absolutely. Her comfort levels are, I think, very restored. She's been having the time of her life. And to me, knowing her as long as I have now, it's like a whole new Shirley Babishoff. She is confident and comfortable and fully in control. The press now, she's become a bit of a darling of the press, which is really nice to watch. She was at the Olympic trials recently in Omaha, Nebraska, and was simply the belle of the ball. You know, she was just faded everywhere and signed tons of books and really had an amazing experience out there. So I think for her, she's ready to talk to people. She likes the opportunity to get out and tell her story now and have people, you know, with the understanding that she was right. Now, in the light of everything we learned, again, once the wall came down and investigators got in there and found the Stasi files, I mean, there were Hitler's doctors writing these prescription programs for these young East German girls who were also very much victims in this horrible scenario. And so we all know that now. So she can speak from a completely different point of view in terms of how she's accepted. Everybody knows she was right. Everybody knows her instincts were on spot. So yeah, it's a great time for her, and she's done some great interviews. And, you know, again, I like watching her being able to bask in a positive glow of the media as opposed to what it was like 40 years ago.
She won 4 silver medals in her individual events in 1976. Is there any possibility, with all that we know now and the documentation that is there to prove it, that those who won the gold could be stripped of their medals?
Well, it's a great question. And Shirley firmly believes that the International Olympic Committee needs to do something now. In fact, the last page of the book is an open letter to the head of the IOC, who in fact is an East German himself. And what Shirley makes the appeal is, look, don't strip the East Germans their medals. That's not what we're looking for. But what we would like are the records to all be restated. We would like everyone to get golds and silvers they would have earned anyhow. Let the East Germans keep what they got, but let's also make room for additional medals. And let's bump everybody up. Look, there are women that came in fourth in certain races where the East Germans won gold, silver, and bronze, okay? And that all of a sudden, that fourth place is a gold medal, and Shirley wants that to be acknowledged. Look, the East German women dominated swimming throughout the entire decade after 76. You know, until that wall came down, they won as much gold as any other team, and nobody said a thing in the 80s. So, in fact, I would start with 76 and then work my way forward and reaward all of those medals. Because, look, we know now, it's not just an opinion, it's a fact. They were cheating, and something should be done about that.
You know, in all the authors I've talked to over the years, I've never had someone give away the end of the book before.
Well, you know what? It makes sense in this case to me, because your question is a very good one, and people are interested in this. And, you know, she's going to send that letter next week, the official day of the book's release, certified to Thomas Bach, the head of the IOC, to say, listen, you know what? I've talked to a lot of people. I firmly believe this. Why can't you do this now? I mean, it's a very polite but firm letter. And, you know, her attitude is, look, what better time than now? If you do it, then everything goes away. All of these questions will no longer be asked, and you would have done the right thing. The IOC, to me, is very stubborn about standing on certain statute of limitations, yet they've broken their own rules. They did it in terms of what they did to Lance Armstrong when they rightfully stripped him. Well, that was longer than the statute, so why can't they go back now? There's no proof that anybody else doped on those swimming teams outside of the East Germans. No one's ever made any kind of accusation. I mean, look, in Montreal that year, the East German team did not even stay in the Olympic Village. They were put on a boat out in the harbor so nobody could get to them. I mean, the coaches were so careful about letting them be exposed to any kind of media. They didn't want them to hear their voices because they were too deep. They didn't want them to see their Adam's apples because they looked like men. I mean, this was the blanket thrown over that team. And the fact that it's all coming out now, I really think calls for the IOC to do something dramatic.
Another fascinating book. This one is called Making Waves. Chris, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I'm always curious to see what you're going to come up with next.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's always a great, you know, thing to talk with you. I know how much you like and understand these kinds of topics. And so, you know, we have these great conversations. So thank you for your time. It always means a lot. And I want to read your book when it comes out.
I look forward to seeing that book in your hands and talking to you about it.
Excellent. I promise we'll do that.
Chris Epting, author of Making Waves. You can check out Chris's website, chrisepting.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0360. And you'll find links to his site, plus links to amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to sword swallower Dan Meyer. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Plus, we have more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, 78-year-old Arthur Brooks placed an ad in the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho Press seeking candidates to interview. The position entails working closely with his son. "My father did this without my consent," said Baron Brooks after the ad run, "and its chief responsibilities include giving Arthur Brooks grandchildren and quickly. Dating in Salt Lake City, Utah has been tough because all of the women I meet already have children," said Baron Brooks. "But that's my problem, not his. However, Arthur Brooks has had heart problems and wants a grandson to carry his family name." The elder Brooks lives in Beverly Hills, California, but the 48-year-old thought his father might have picked northern Idaho for its conservative values. Well, what could be more conservative than being picked by a father to marry his son? Yeah. And what's in a name, you ask? Well, police in Washington Township, Pennsylvania, were called to a domestic disturbance and arrived to find the male half of the dispute with a kitchen knife lodged in his chest. 42-year-old Donald Barber said his live-in girlfriend threw a knife at him but missed, so she grabbed another one and delivered it directly to her target. The wound was apparently superficial. Tammy Lynn Hade was charged with aggravated assault. The name I was talking about before? It's the street they live on. It's called Lover's Lane. I think now they, by law or some reason, would have to move. Well, you know what they always say, by the way? The way to a man's heart apparently is between his third and fourth ribs. And Brigham Young University professor Jason Hansen apologized in May for coaxing a student for extra credit to drink a small vial of his urine in class. The physiology session was on kidney function, and Hansen thought the stunt would call attention to urine's unique properties. He confessed later that the urine was just food coloring with vinegar added, that he had used the stunt in previous classes, and that he usually admits the ruse at the next class session. Nonetheless, Hansen's department chair suggested he retire the concept. You know, to me, the bigger lesson here in all of this is just how far some students will go for extra credit. I mean, I don't think this is something I would follow through in, even if I was a borderline student just passing. There are certain things you can't get me to do. But hey, what some students will do for extra credit? I don't know. Some people have their limits, some people don't. What can I say? Anyway, each week on this program, we air Let's Be Fair with Bob Dorigo-Jones, which features stories about litigious lawsuits in the United States. But I have a couple of doozies here, and one of them is not even from America. But first, the American one. Insurance agent John Wright filed a lawsuit in Will County, Illinois, in June over teenagers playing Ding Dong Ditch, in which kids ring a doorbell but run away before the resident answers. The lawsuit claims that 14-year-old bell ringer Brendan Papp caused Wright severe emotional distress, anxiety, and weight loss, resulting in at least $30,000 in lost income. Wow. Income and weight loss over a doorbell? Someone is wound way too tight. Or maybe, just maybe, they should change their ringtone to, like, soothing chimes or waterfalls or something. Because, wow, doorbells and a weight loss? Yikes. And number two, the ex-boyfriend of Nina Zerkaska filed a lawsuit in Serbia after she broke up with him for his reluctance to pop the question after a two-year courtship. The man, not named in a dispatch from Moscow, demanded compensation for his dating expenses. The trial court ruled against him, but he is appealing. You know, I think Nina probably dodged a bullet in not waiting for a proposal from this clown. Consider herself lucky. Very, very lucky. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, there's usually irony in stories we title Undignified Deaths, and this time around we have two that certainly fit the bill. Number one, Australian lawyer William Ray was killed on May 22nd when he was thrown from his all-terrain quad bike in rural Victoria State and pinned underneath. Ray had come to prominence by representing Honda as the company balked at mandatory installation of anti-roll bars on quad bikes. Well, that disproved his point in that one. And number two, a 48-year-old employee at North Central Bronx Hospital in New York City died of a heart attack at work on June the 7th, under circumstances, according to police, indicating that he was viewing a pornographic video at the moment of his death. And that, folks, is the comings and goings of life. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here, shall we? We've spoken to Dan Meyer several times over the years. He's the president of the Sword Swallowers Association International, has helmed several highly popular TED Talks, and recently he's been seen on America's Got Talent once again, where his latest feat really has to be seen to be believed. Dan joins us on the line from Florida. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Peter.
Pleasure to talk to you once again. I remember when we first chatted, or at least one of the times we first chatted, it was back when you were on America's Got Talent, I guess it was way back in 2008.
2008, yep, about 8 years ago.
So how did you get on the show again, now in 2016?
It was totally a fluke. They called me out of the blue on a Monday afternoon and said, hey, would you like to be back on America's Got Talent? I said, sure, when? 2017? What, Miami, Orlando? They said, no, tomorrow, Hollywood. I'm like, what? And we made things happen very quickly. I flew in late the next day and got in about 2 in the morning, and we filmed all day that day, and I finally, they had me come on about midnight that night. And what you see on tape was after about 2 days of travel with about 3 hours of sleep and no food. But it was so much fun, and it went over way better than I could have ever hoped for or imagined.
Now, as I said in the introduction, the latest feat you did on that show really has to be seen to be believed. And as you mentioned, you did it on such short notice and with so little sleep. To me, that makes it even more impressive. People have seen Sword Swallowers before, but what you did was totally different. Explain the car pulling thing.
Okay, I'm going to back up just a little bit. The first thing I did was, and actually, there's a little backstory that they did not tell on that you can't see on America's Got Talent. When I went out there, Simon kind of looked at me and said, so are you here to win the $1 million? You know, is that what you're here for? I said, well, not really. I said, and he said, what are you here for? Who are you here to speak to? You know, and I said, I'm here for all those bullies who teased me as a little kid, who used to beat me up and say I'd never amount to anything. I'm here for my family and friends and God who give me the strength and the courage to do what I do around the world. And mostly I'm here for everybody out there who's ever been told, you're no good, you're never going to amount to anything. That's why I'm here. And, you know, the folks kind of taking a breath there. And then Heidi said, she said something to me like, you know, I really hate these kind of danger acts, but she said, but we're all rooting for you. Let's see what you can do. And I decided I would start with my first long sword, which is about a 30-inch sword with a 24-inch long blade. Now, Peter, this is one that I swallow kind of day in and day out as my finale for my act, but it's a regular for me. So I backed up under a camera that was an overhead camera and just swallowed that sword, lifted up and dropped it, and I did a no-hands drop and let it drop, and then I flung it up in the air like that. And, you know, that's kind of nothing for me. Well, the audience rose to their feet in a standing ovation for my first sword. And I'm thinking, oh, come on, folks, that's my easy one. And then I said, let's take it to another level. And I pulled out an antique 1929 Model A car axle that had been swallowed by a sword swallower named Arthur Plumhoff back in the 1930s, I guess. And it had been handed down from him to another sword swallower, to a sideshow guy, to this old sword swallower who had passed it on to me, and I'd never swallowed it on national TV, and it weighed, I don't know, 8 to 10 pounds. It's extremely heavy. And I lifted that thing up and swallowed it, and that went pretty well, and the people were still standing. There was no response. They just had their jaws dropped. And then I said, nah, let's take it to another level. Let's do something, you know, not just part of a car, but let's use an entire car. And I said, but I'm going to need more weight in this car. Nick, I need you to get in. And I asked Nick Cannon to get in the car. And it was a 1974 Triumph Spitfire car. They had just driven it over there that afternoon from some place that they rented it from. And Heidi said to me, she said, you know, are you sure you can do this? And I said, no, I'm not sure I can do this. I've never seen this car before. I've never tried it before in this car. I'm not sure I can do it with this car. And we hooked it up, and I pulled it about 12, 15 feet or whatever, and got about, I got some great comments from Howie, and Simon said he loved it, which really surprised me. And they gave me 4 yes votes.
Now we have
better than I could have expected.
We have to describe this a little bit for those who didn't see it. What you did was you swallowed a sword, and attached to the sword were I guess some sort of cables, which was attached to the front of the car. And with that sword down your throat, you pulled the car across the stage.
That's right. It was about a 20-inch sword. I had to make sure it was short enough that it didn't puncture the bottom of my stomach. And I had about 2,800 or 3,000 pounds of car pushing down on my teeth and on the bottom of my stomach. And then no hands, I leaned forward. And at first it didn't move, but they don't show that on the episode. It did not move, did not. And I thought, uh-oh, this is not working. And I leaned and leaned and leaned and just kept pulling it. Finally, it started to nudge. And I pulled it about, I don't know, 12 feet or something. And, man, that was... The elation, I didn't sleep for about 3 hours after that, after I finally did. It was really great.
Well, I got to say, as I mentioned, I've talked to you several times. I've seen you perform several times. And when I saw that, that was the most impressive thing I have ever seen. I mean, I don't know how you managed to top what I've seen you do before, but that was amazing.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was, you know, it was, and honestly, I'm not the first guy that's ever done it. There was another sword swallower up in Canada. Up in Edmonton, I believe, Edmonton that did it several years before that. And then I had done it in 2013 for Ripley's Baltimore for their grand opening there. But this is the first time I just totally did it on short notice. And man, it's been fun. It's been a fun ride.
How does one even develop into being a sword swallower? How do you know that's something you can do?
It wasn't. For me, as a little kid, I grew up with extreme fears. I didn't think I could do anything. And then finally, when I was on my deathbed at my 21st birthday, I decided I was going to put my fears to death and take on risks and challenges and make a list of crazy thromes or major life goals that I wanted to do. And little by little, one thing has led to another, to travel the world and to see Mount Everest. And you know, I finally learned juggling and then stilt walking and unicycle riding. In 1997, I heard there were less than a dozen sword swallowers left in the entire world. And I said, I've got to try it. And I began practicing. I practiced 10 to 12 times a day, every day for 4 years, a total of about 13,000 unsuccessful attempts before I got my first sword down my throat in 2001. And then it's just grown from there. Last year, I broke the Guinness World Record, which was 24 swords at once, was their record. I broke it by doing 29. At Ripley's St. Augustine. And so it's, you know, you're just constantly kind of pushing the envelope and stretching it, you know.
Wow.
And it's taken me the past 15 years now. I've done this in like 40 countries around the world, and this is my whole career. It's my calling. It's my life purpose is to inspire other people that they can overcome their fears and do the impossible in their lives. And that's what I do with TED Talks all around the world. And I love doing it, talking to folks like you.
You mentioned you were on your deathbed at the age of 21. What was the life-changing situation that made you, you know, essentially create this rather interesting bucket list of yours?
I was living as a missionary in India, in Tamil Nadu, South India. And it was the week before my 21st birthday, and my best buddy there, my mentor, said, do you have thromes, Daniel? I said, thromes? What are thromes? And he said, thromes are major life goals, like a bucket list. And I said, no, I could never do that. I'm too scared. I got too many fears. And that night, it was really hot out. It was 105, about 40 Celsius, and went to the roof of my bungalow and slept out under the stars, watched the bats dive bomb for mosquitoes. And all I could think about was thromes. and what I wanted to do when I hit my 21st birthday. And that night I came down with severe malaria fever. And for about 5 or 6 days, I was in and out of consciousness on my deathbed, fighting for my life with a 105 degree fever. And when I was conscious, all I could think about was Thrones and what I wanted to do with my life. So finally, on the night before my 21st birthday, I kind of came to a realization. I realized, you know what? Fear, danger is real. Fear is a choice. And I don't need to fear, you know, fear itself. I need to just move forward and forget about fears and make a list of Thrones. And I did. I decided I wanted to travel the world, learn a bunch of languages, visit the seven wonders of the world, live on an island, live on a ship in the ocean, climb to the top of the highest mountain in Sweden, see Mount Everest at sunrise, live with the tribe of Indians, work with a circus, work in the music business in Nashville. And little by little over the next few years, you know, as something would cross my path, I'd say, that's one of my Thrones. I'm going to go for it. And little by little, I crossed all those off, and I'd add more and more Thrones to my list. Every time I'd cross one off my list, I'd add 5 or 10 more new ones to my list. And so it just kept growing, and it went from, you know, juggling to stilt walking to fire eating to glass eating to sword swallowing. And now that's gone to pulling cars, and now I've hit about 40 countries around the world, and I'm shooting for 100. So, and my here's my message for your listeners. I don't care who you are, what you came from. I grew up with social anxiety disorder, beat up and teased by the bullies. But you can do whatever you want. Just make your Thrones greater than your fears. And don't worry about the fears. Go for your goals. Go for your Thrones. Go for your dreams. And you can do the impossible in your life.
The thing that's always impressed me about you when watching you on stage, whatever stage that might be, is not just the talent you possess in being a sword swallower, which is a rather unique profession, but it's the fact that you look like you're having so much fun while doing it. You look, when you're on stage, like you're the happiest person on the planet.
And you know what, Peter? I am. I mean, when I tell people, when you find your purpose, your calling, what you're put here on earth to do, your mission, and who you're supposed, it's not about us and what we do for ourselves. It's about helping other people. And when I find that, you know, when I found it, it's just my light bulb went off, and it's like, yes, life is fun. I love this. I love waking up on Monday morning and waiting for my phone to ring and going into work, you know. And so I love talking to people like you in audiences just around the world. I just got an interview request for Italy, for France, and for India today, all in the past half hour before I talked to you. And that's what, you know, it just, that's what turns me on. That's what, it's knowing what my life's purpose and calling is, and then going out and doing it.
Excellent. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and continued success with all that you do. And we'll be watching the further installments of America's Got Talent to see how far you go, and hopefully it'll be all the way.
Aw, thank you so much, Peter. Appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Sword swallower Dan Meyer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0360, and you'll find the links to Dan's page. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine this scenario. A man walks into a hospital with chest pains and fears the worst. The doctor orders a blood test, and it shows no elevated enzymes that would indicate a heart attack. However, the patient urges additional testing, and after some more expensive tests, the final diagnosis is indigestion. According to surveys, doctors say they routinely order more tests than are clinically needed for two main reasons: to eliminate patient anxiety, and to avoid being sued. Ordering these extra tests is called defensive medicine, and it comes with a huge price tag. Even with the Affordable Care Act, insurance premiums are expected to rise an average of about 10% next year in metropolitan areas, in large part because of defensive medicine. Let's be fair. If we're going to bring sanity to healthcare spending and cut insurance rates, wasteful spending has to be eliminated. A nonpartisan group called Patients for Fair Compensation has developed a plan that would replace this broken system with a new one. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And direct, not from Liverpool, here is Stuart Nauman.
Thank you, Peter. How you like that? Well, it's not from the cavern. I mean, yeah. You ever tried to go to the cavern back in the heyday of the Beatles, back in the about 50, 60 years ago?
No, because my parents wouldn't have let me.
No, you probably wouldn't have. I wasn't around. But it was kind of a hot place, literally. So, you know, it's a little bit more. That's why we're not in Liverpool right now. We're in a more comfortable spot right now. But, yes, now that you mentioned about the Liverpool reference, because on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a biography of Paul McCartney. Because to say that music was Paul McCartney's life is indeed an understatement. From his father James's jazz band during the 20s, to appreciating Elvis and Little Richard records while growing up in Liverpool, yes, and going to the Cavern, to his years playing those clubs in Liverpool and Hamburg as the part of the Quarrymen, which was the precursor to the Beatles, to becoming one half of the most successful songwriting team of the rock era with John Lennon, to a successful solo career with Wings, to a classical operatic composer, to helming a mega-successful concert tour that is still going on full steam to this day. I mean, he's going nonstop, Paul. But Paul McCartney has built such a continuing successful career in music, yet there's so much more to McCartney than goes beyond the music. Now, Philip Norman, a veteran British rock journalist and author who has written a string of critically acclaimed best-selling rock music biographies that included John Lennon, Mick Jagger, Elton John, and the Beatles as his subjects, has managed to delve deeply into the nearly 75 years of the life and music of Paul McCartney and how he has transformed from Quarryman to Beatle to Sir Paul to Maka, and it's the subject of his latest book, Paul McCartney, The Life. Now, what makes Norman's book stand out from the other biographical treatments of McCartney is for two reasons. First, it's the very first comprehensive biography of McCartney, which not only covers his years in Liverpool and with the Beatles, but goes beyond 1970 to cover his post-Beatle years with Linda, Wings, Heather Mills, and Rap to the present. And second, because although McCartney did not do any interviews with Norman for the book, he gave the author his quote-unquote tacit approval to speak to anyone who was associated with him, whether it be friends, family members, colleagues, etc., you know, instead of that. So the end result is probably one of the most balanced, definitive looks into the making of a rock music legend.
Does it touch on the part, does it mention the anything about when he died in the 60s?
Yes, that, yes, everything. Even though the Paul is dead, rumors and everything, yes, touches that also.
Wow.
But the reader is fully immersed into the musical world of Paul McCartney, which is one of the things I liked about it, as we discover many behind-the-scenes stories of the circumstances and inspirations that propelled McCartney to create some of his greatest songs and albums. For example, he decided to go to Nigeria with Linda and Denny Lane to record what would be the commercially successful, critically successful 1973 album, Band on the Run. The problem was that Nigeria was still in the midst of violent civil unrest that trickled down from the Biafra crisis less than a decade before. And on the way home from a recording session, Paul and Linda were stopped by a group of murderous thieves who took his briefcase that was filled with his notes and arrangements for the album, which the thieves mistook for money.
Huh.
Yeah. So he got away with, with his life. And, you know, because Paul had such a great memory, he managed to redo those arrangements from that memory, note for note.
Wow.
Amazing. But it's also an unflinching examination of McCartney as Norman looks at some of the less savory aspects of his life and career that is like McCartney without tears and gives the book a more balanced and sense of honesty to it. Now, perhaps the most salacious, gossipy, and luridly fascinating aspect of the book, that part of it, is the section dealing with his tempestuous marriage to British amputee model and TV host Heather Mills.
Who we will continue to refer to now as simply the gold digger.
The gold digger. I thought I was going to say Lady Macbeth for some reason.
Oh, that's a good one, too. That works.
We do get the full picture of this doomed marriage, why it happened in the first place, and the bitter resentment it caused not only with the public, but also with McCartney's children, who viewed Mills as, you say, a shameless gold digger. And Norman includes the deposition document that was compiled by Mills' attorney that was a virtual shopping list of psychological, verbal, and physical abuse on McCartney's part that was supposed to portray him as the villain of the nasty divorce proceedings that went on between them. Now, whether the allegations are true or false is up to the judgment of the reader, but nonetheless, it makes for rather absorbing tabloid-style reading. This book, Paul McCartney of Life, is a probing, realistic account about the lad from Liverpool who was born and raised with a love of music and how he emerged from the grimy streets of Liverpool and evolved, both personally and professionally, from the souffle-talking cute Beatle to a much-revered rock music icon.
And the book is entitled?
It's called Paul McCartney, The Life. It's by Philip Norman. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $38.50.
And what do you recommend in a similar vein, sir?
Well, I recommend author written by Philip Norman, Shout, The Beatles and Their Generation, which was published in 1981, which was the first serious and in-depth look at the life and career of the group and the world and the circumstances that made them, you know, such rock legends, you know, the timing, their influences. It's regarded still as one of the best books about the Beatles. And also, The Love You Make by Peter Brown, who was a former staffer with the Beatles, you know, like part of the entourage, like Neil Aspinall, Mal Evans, Derek Taylor. And it was the first book by a Beatle insider. It's a very fascinating piece of insider memoir. It gives a little look at Paul McCartney, the Lothario. I have some interesting stories there. But it's a fascinating look at the Beatles from the inside, as from one of the people who worked closely with the group.
Excellent. So how do people find... first of all, let's mention once again this week's book. It is...
It's called Paul McCartney, The Life by Philip Norman, published by Little Brown. It costs only $38.50.
And how do people find you? I'm assuming they don't have to twist and shout or yell help.
No, you'll go, yeah, 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 as you check me out on the Montreal Times, not the Liverpool Echo. In print every Saturday or online, www.mtltimes.ca.
So that means we won't find you in an octopus's garden?
No, not by the sea. And thank God I won't be looking behind my back for Maxwell Silver Hammer.
Okay, thank you very much, Stuart, for being on the program with us once again.
We welcome Peter. Bye.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, and I do have one more Stuff File news story to share with you, but I just want to quickly mention that we'd love to hear from you here at the Stuff File program. You can just send me an email with your thoughts or questions about the show, and we'll respond. Just email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And some of the questions might even make it into the air, or onto the air, I should say, in our mailbag section. So do write. Also, Facebook users, we urge you to join the Stuff File fan page. It's easy to find. It's at facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. We'd love to have you as part of the fun because, as you know what they say, the more the merrier. Yes. And remember, folks, we always remind you, this show is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, regular listeners to this show already know how I feel about cats. They're little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. So I do have a mild interest in what a team of researchers are doing. They are following about 30 tabbies, calicos, and others, recording their moves and sounds to somehow learn whether house cats have dialects in their meows and alter their patterns of stress and intonation when they speak to other cats or to humans. In explaining the project, linguist Robert Eklund of Sweden's Linköping University personally sounded out a pretty wide range of meows to illustrate his points, according to a New York Magazine interviewer that he spoke to in April. Eklund is already an expert on feline purring. Yeah, an expert on feline purring. Bet you didn't know there was one, huh? And you can find out more about it at purring.org. That's right, purring.org. And he is an expert, although from a distance, because as he admits, he is allergic to cats. Then why pick this job, pal? That's what I want to know. Anyway, You know what time it is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time for the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time once again for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
After two robberies netting $4,220 from a bank in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and a credit union in Miramar, investigators were anxious to get the lone female robber. The break came when the second demand note, which was left behind, had fingerprints. Those were matched to 27-year-old Ashley Cambridge, and a mugshot from an earlier arrest resembled a good security camera photo taken at the first robbery. Cambridge was apprehended at her Hollywood apartment hours after the second robbery, and when shown the security camera photos, she circled herself in several photos and wrote "me" by them, and then signed her name. Police say the demand note she passed to tellers started with, "Don't try anything stupid." Well, clearly, she didn't take her own advice, because why, oh why, would someone circle themselves in a security photo, write the word "me," and sign it for the cops when questioned about a robbery? Well, one reason, and one reason only: she's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0360. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0360. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night, and pass the paprika.